From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Climate change is changing a lot about how we live, so is it changing how we grow the food that we eat? Well, slowly but surely, on farmland across America, the answer is yes. Farmers and scientists are figuring out new ways to grow the foods and raise the livestock we all eat in anticipation of a future of different growing seasons, different pests, and wilder storms. They're also trying to pollute less and leave more carbon in the ground. This hour on Point, the future of farming in a changing climate. And you can join us, especially farmers. Are you thinking ahead and changing your methods because the climate around you is changing? And for all of us, are we relieved? Are you relieved to hear that the people who grow and raise what you eat are thinking ahead to a future of unavoidable climate change effects? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, we decided to look at this question of farming in the age of climate change because the online news service E&E News is running a really great series on this subject. It's called Recipe for Change, and we have a link to the series at our website, onpointradio.org. And two of the reporters who worked on this series are with us today. Daniel Cusick joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota. He covers climate adaptation for E&E News. Daniel, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also with us is Mark Heller. He covers agriculture for E&E, and he's with us from Washington. Mark, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, give us the overview of what the aim, the animating question here that your series is asking and the aim of it. And Mark or Daniel, I'm not sure who the better one is to throw this question to, but go ahead.
Well, I'll go ahead and start. excuse me. This project was conceived last fall by an editor at Greenwire, Colleen Lucioli, and brought together a number of reporters from different publications and different backgrounds to look at a question that really hadn't been sufficiently covered in our minds with respect to climate change, the causes of climate change, and also the response to climate change. There's been a tremendous amount of attention paid to other sectors that are emitting greenhouse gases, including the energy sector, transportation sector, industrial sector. But agriculture has, while it hasn't been completely ignored, we thought it deserved some additional attention. And our interest really went beyond just agriculture or just agriculture, but to the food system itself. So it's a little more broad than just what farmers are doing in the field, but also how food is moving to consumers.
Right. So because a lot of potential climate effects there. And we should also note that the series touches upon fishing as well. But for the context of this hour, though, we thought we would just focus on farming and land-based agriculture. So, Mark, tell us a little bit about, you know, what have you been hearing over the course of your reporting about how climate change is already having an impact on agricultural practices?
Well, I would say that I'm hearing a lot from farmers who are experiencing all kinds of effects from drought and flood and wind and hurricanes and all that manner of thing. The question is whether they see that in the broader context of global climate change that is caused by human beings, or whether they just see this as extreme weather, and that starts to get into a political debate. But certainly farmers are more accepting now, I think, of the idea that something is going on and that they need to respond to it and adapt to it.
So then tell me more, like, what are the particular reasons why you see a shift in that, the greater receptivity?
Oh, I think because the effects are just becoming so undeniable. I think that's really what it is. I think you're seeing growers who are having their cotton fields flooded out and that sort of thing. And you can't deny that there's something going on, and it's going on more. All over the place, when I talk to farmers, they say that what they're experiencing, people tell them they haven't seen in decades and decades, if ever.
Wow. Oh, so Daniel, did you want to chime in on that?
Sure. Well, I'm in Minnesota, and I cover Mississippi River issues. And of course, for the last several months, I've been covering flood issues in particular. And if you need an example of how climate change is affecting extreme weather and extreme events, you can just look back over the last 3, 4, 5 months. In fact, back to as late as late 2018, when just a set of extreme events happened in the Mississippi River Basin, largely in the Midwest, but also extending to some other areas. And it resulted in what, for many communities, is the flood of record, larger than 1993, in some cases larger than 1927, which is the known as the Great Flood on the Mississippi River, particularly the lower Mississippi River. So I just say, for people who are looking for examples of how climate change is intersecting with farming, you can just look at these floods, these dramatic floods that have happened very recently.
Wow. Okay. So, Mark, talk to us about another specific examples, because I think sort of really making this as real as possible for as many people as possible is going to be helpful here. Your next story, or an upcoming story in this series, has to do with a different kind of water issue, and that's increasing drought in California and how that's affecting winemakers there.
Yeah. So I spent several days in Napa and Sonoma talking to wine growers there. And of course, out there, they see drought right in front of their faces. This is something they deal with on a regular basis, and so they are dealing with water issues. In fact, every grower I spoke to there said that their number one concern is the water supply and what they are supposed to do long term. They're a little bit lucky in that part of California in that a little bit of dryness, or maybe even a good amount of dryness, is good for the wine, which added another sort of level to the discussion. But out there, there's no denying that precipitation is a serious issue.
Well, I mean, in your reporting is going to reveal some interesting things. Like, I had no idea that it took more than 300 gallons of water on average per gallon of wine.
Yes, there's an immense amount of water, especially on the vineyard. You think about all the different uses. Irrigation is number one, but there's also water that they spray when there's a frost predicted. There's water that they use to clean out the barrels in the winery. There's all manner of uses of water that they're trying to conserve.
Okay, but is this idea then of dry farming, is it going to catch on in California? Or they're just, I mean, because so much of agriculture is just absolutely dependent on irrigation and other water sources.
Yeah. I think in that part, that specific part of California, in Napa, I think that from what I heard from people, that has some real good merit to it. There are other parts of the state. I was told Central Valley places. You can't do that. It's just too dry. And if you look at the rain patterns in California, they vary so widely by location over short distances.
Wow. And so then this is just really interesting. And you will also you talk about how Napa Valley wineries, they cut down a lot of trees when they expand, and that has climate effects.
Well, it's not good for people will tell you that it's not particularly good for the land if you're going and you're cutting down trees and going into hillsides and things like that.
Yeah. Well,
that's more of an environmental issue.
But, sure. Yeah. And then trees trees pull carbon out of the atmosphere in the process of respiration. But that's just a little hint of terms of, you know, from industry to industry within agriculture, how, you know, climate change is having an impact. That's making a lot of people think about it. So Mark Heller and Daniel Cusick, hold on for just a second here, because I actually want to go to the callers. We've got Aaron, who is calling from Peshtigo, Wisconsin. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I, we raise grass-fed beef here in northeast Wisconsin, and we've had an impact from climate change for sure. I mean, the last few years, we've had extremely wet springs, haven't been able to get field work done. And so we've become increasingly more reliant on our perennial cool season pastures, those permanent grasses and clovers that you don't have to plant every year because we just can't get equipment in during the springtime. We've had to change how we do things in the summertime as well. We're going towards more drought-tolerant crops like sorghum, sedan grass, things that don't need a lot of water, not as much as corn. And so we're trying to make adaptations, and it seems to be working, but the weather is always a challenge.
Oh, well, Aaron, so don't go away just yet. So you're trying to make these adaptations. Are you seeing immediate effects, or is it tough to make this transition?
For us, it's been pretty easy. You know, cool season pastures are the backbone of the grass-fed beef industry, and so that we already had those in place. We've had to change how we reestablish those, though. We don't do spring seedings anymore. It's just too variable of weather. We do late summer seedings when the weather's a little bit more predictable. But, you know, we don't have a lot of big investment in equipment to plant corn and beans like a lot of farms do. And so for us, it's been easy to be flexible. But for a lot of people that are ingrained in that commodity row crop agriculture, it's definitely a challenge.
Wow. Well, Aaron from Peshtigo, Wisconsin, thank you so much for your call. Daniel Cusick, what do you think? You hear Aaron making some pretty rapid changes as a grass-fed beef farmer.
Yes, that's right. And Aaron used a key term, which is adaptation. Farmers everywhere are trying to learn on the job, so to speak, of how to adapt to changing conditions. And just briefly to touch on what Mark was saying about water in the West, farmers for generations have talked about getting the water right, which means having the right amount of water in the right seasons to grow crops that in some cases are fairly specialized, in some cases not. But what we're seeing now is this higher degree of variability in water. Too little, then too much, then too little again, then too much again. And it's falling in patterns that are also new. As Aaron mentioned, Wisconsin last year had some tremendous storms, tremendous volumes of water falling over that state. And it affected farmers greatly in a variety of reasons. Number one, their fields were flooded. You can't do agriculture with a flooded field. Mm-hmm. But also, if they have too much water, it really affects the ability to grow crops and raise livestock in a way that they often have or usually have.
Well, Daniel Cusick and Mark Heller, both from E&E News, stand by for just a second because we're talking about their series on how a changing climate is forcing or encouraging changes in agriculture practices or in the food system more broadly. We'll be back with a lot more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mark Heller and Daniel Cusick. They're both from E&E News, and it's a website that recently launched a really fascinating series about how climate change is changing agriculture practice, or more broadly, the food system in general, and how farmers are responding to that. And we have links to the reporting at onpointradio.org. If you're a farmer or anyone in our agriculture and food system, have you seen the effects of climate change on what you do, and how are you responding? Now, I want to, Daniel and Mark, I want to play a quick clip here. This is from the Land Institute. It's a research organization based in Kansas that's working to develop grain crops that don't have to be replanted every year. Now, that prevents erosion. Not having to replant keeps erosion at bay. It also keeps the soil healthier. And in the case of a new wheatgrass called Kernza, it can trap even more carbon in its deep roots. So here's Lee DeHaan, the lead Kernza scientist, in a video that this video, we should note, was put out by the clothing company Patagonia.
We have perennial plants that we eat that are apples, pears, nuts. But when it comes to something that is the staple of the human diet on large scales, we don't have any options. So we're trying to bring the perenniality of the perennial grass with the features of wheat that we like. Big seed, stuff we can make bread out of, good yield. And we're trying to bring those two things together from different species. That's a very complicated, challenging task, and we're still working on that here.
So that's a clip from a video, again, and we mentioned it was put out by the clothing company Patagonia because they have a foundation that's supporting the research into this wheatgrass called Kernza. Now, Daniel Cusick, you wrote about this, and you wrote about how this is an example of one of the shifts in cropland agriculture that could have a major effect on climate change. So what's the deal with Kernza?
Well, it is a very interesting crop, and in some ways it's been one of the holy grails of crop agriculture, in that scientists for years have been trying to find a viable perennial crop, in other words, one that doesn't have to be tilled up annually, that also produces grains for food. And this has been a traditionally difficult area because so much of what we grow in the United States is fairly shallow-rooted, which makes it more susceptible to drought, extreme events, and other things. So, excuse me. So Kernza is essentially a hybridized form of what's called intermediate wheatgrass, which is a fairly common plant. It's been in the United States for many, many years, but has traditionally not been used for food. It has been used more for watershed protection, wellhead protection, roadside planting, so on and so forth. But the Land Institute, in conjunction with the University of Minnesota, has been working on a plant breeding program for some time to improve the food qualities of this plant, which has now been trademarked as Kernza by the Land Institute. Generically, it's called intermediate wheatgrass.
Right. So from your reporting here, I see that the root system of Kernza is, I don't know, it looks like the roots may penetrate the soil 10 times as much or 10 times as deep as other wheat species.
That's right. One of the really distinguishing features of Kernza is it has a very deep root system.
10 feet or more in the ground.
That's correct. In fact, the root system is much longer and deeper than the plant itself, which I think for many people that's a little bit different than what they would expect. But this extensive root system that goes very deep into the ground is a terrific storer of carbon, and also the fact that it doesn't have to be tilled every year, it doesn't have to be replanted every year, allows Kernza to absorb and store carbon for the entire year. So it doesn't lose that carbon. It loses a little by other means, but overall it retains its carbon absorption and storage potential year round.
Is there increasing interest in Kernza? I mean, because I imagine that we can have as many small farmers as possible take up something like this as a new farming practice. But in order to really sort of push things forward, the corporate agriculture companies need to get interested. Are they?
Yes. And to your point, markets matter in farming just as they matter in any other enterprise. Kernza has drawn some interest. It's still largely in the research phase, although it is being used in some products, including those made by Patagonia through their food division called Patagonia Provisions. More recently, General Mills, which is, of course, one of the largest food conglomerates in the world, has embraced Kernza, largely through its relationship with the University of Minnesota and the Land Institute, and is investing in not only in the research and development of the Kernza plant, but also working very hard to incorporate Kernza grain into its foods, which of course includes cereals and lots of other food products.
Ah, interesting. So, but I guess I should also ask, just for basic understanding here, you mentioned the reasons why Kernza may be good, though not a silver bullet, as you point out in your reporting, but its deep root system, its carbon-trapping abilities, et cetera. Is the flip side of that about why corn and wheat may not be so great for when we're thinking about climate and climate change? What's so bad about corn and wheat?
There's nothing inherently bad about corn and wheat, but the way we produce corn and wheat, it does pose some problems from a climate standpoint. I guess first and foremost would be that corn and wheat conventionally require annual tillage. And you mentioned soil and mm-hmm. soil health a short time ago. Soil is a tremendous holder of carbon. So when you till the soil annually to plant a new crop, you are actually losing many, many, many millions of tons of carbon back into the air. So it essentially reverses the carbon cycle with plants. Plants are known to absorb carbon. That's why we call them carbon sinks. But with some agricultural practices, we're flipping that on its head and actually releasing very large amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. Mm. So tilling is a big issue there. Also, the plants, particularly corn, is a relatively short-rooted or shallow-rooted plant. It's carbon absorption potential or performance is much lower than annual crops and particularly native plants. Native prairie plants in particular are known to be some of the most effective carbon absorbers in the plant world. Mm-hmm. So a plant like Kernza is trying to draw some of the benefits of these native prairie grasses while also meeting needs for food.
Yeah. Well, Mark, you've been very patient there waiting while we're talking about Kernza here. I want to go to a quick caller and then I'll come back to you. So let's go to Tucker, who's calling from Edgartown, Massachusetts. Tucker, you're on the air.
Hi, Mina. Thanks so much for taking my call.
No problem. Go ahead.
So I have a log-grown shiitake farm that we've been growing the business of here on the island, and we sell into restaurants in Boston and New York. And really the reason why my business partner and I got into this particular type of farming is with an eye to climate change and how we can use marginalized land for a type of farming that doesn't require soil, but in fact uses agricultural or forest waste products. So in this case, we're using wasted crown wood, which normally gets chipped or burned from oak forestry operations. And mushrooms can provide a massive amount of protein and fiber to replace more traditional animal proteins. But I'm curious as to what your panelists think about changing food culture to the point where we are using more food items that don't require limited arable land,
right,
and instead utilize agricultural waste.
Well, Tucker, really great question, and thank you so much for your call. Mark Heller, would you want to respond to her?
That's fascinating. You know, I hadn't heard too much about that. My knowledge of mushrooms has always been that they grow it in bales of hay. I'm curious, I guess, a little bit more about Tucker's operation and how you all decided how to do this, actually. Just the reporter in me is very curious about it.
Well, it looks like we don't have Tucker on the line anymore, unfortunately.
Okay.
but maybe we can get another mushroom farmer to call us and help answer that question. So Mark Heller and Daniel Cusick, stand by here for just a second, because I do want to reach out to Belgrade, Montana, where Becky Weed joins us. She and her husband are sheep ranchers on a 160-acre farm. She's also vice chair of the Montana Organic Association and co-author of the Montana Climate Assessment. She has served as well on the Montana Board of Livestock. So, Becky Weed, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
It's really great to have you. So, first of all, just kind of give us a broad sense. Have you been seeing the effects of a changing climate on your ranch?
Yeah, we do see effects. We've been here for about 32 years, and I would say in general temperatures are warmer, but what's more striking is that the extremes are greater. Last March, we ended up lambing at 35 below zero, which felt very wrong and is not what we consider to be normal. So there are definitely changes, but what's really important to emphasize is that the changes have not been reliably predictable, mm-hmm. and volatility is the name of the game as much as warming is.
So how are you coping then with that volatility?
Well, in our case, like the person who called from Wisconsin, we're in a relatively good position. We're grass farmers. We raise sheep. And in fact, that's part of the reason we chose to raise sheep. Before I was a farmer, I was a geologist, and that perspective has deeply influenced my understanding of agriculture and its role on the planet. And grass farming is a relatively resilient way to operate. And even though it focuses primarily on livestock, it's also, I think, a tool for restoring healthier versions of cropland agriculture as well.
Yeah. So let's take, Becky, if I can, I just want to take a tiny tangent. So you were a geologist before you were a farmer. And were you working on carbon-related issues or climate issues as a geologist?
It's a little bit different from that.
Okay.
Initially, as an undergraduate, I was working in some of the wildest places on Earth on very ancient rocks. But then in graduate school, I was working in the dry valleys of Antarctica, and I ended up working with two different groups. One group were microbial ecologists who were studying the rock surfaces, but then I also ended up collaborating with a team of glacial geologists who are studying the history of climate change in the Southern Hemisphere and trying to understand how it drives global climate change. And even as a freshman in college, which was a long time ago in the late 70s, I was learning about rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere, and I can remember sitting there as an 18-year-old in an introductory geochemistry class thinking, wow, the writing is on the wall. And so even though I have dedicated my adult life to small-scale agriculture, it's always with that backdrop. And really the main point that it leaves me with is that the strategies that we need in agriculture to build resilience in the face of climate change are the same strategies that we need for agriculture to help mitigate climate change.
Okay. Okay. So Daniel and Mark, I have 100 questions for Becky, but I also want to recognize that I have two reporters here sitting as well as part of this conversation. Do you, Mark, let me turn to you. What do you hear what Becky's saying? And do you have any questions for her in terms of what she's doing out in Montana?
I'm curious, maybe for one thing, whether she's more concerned about temperature variations or moisture variations where she is, for one thing. And then I had another impression a little bit from what she mentioned about the strategy for resilience, because that's what I hear. That's what I hear a lot, that the kinds of measures that farmers can take both mitigate the effects upon them and help with the broader problem. And a lot of them aren't even necessarily geared toward climate change specifically, but toward just growing better crops.
Mm. Becky, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, that was really two questions. The first question about our primary concerns. I live in southwest Montana in a valley that's somewhat anomalous, where our immediate concern is not aridity, although we do experience some droughts. But I would say when I think about my Montana colleagues in general, drought is a major concern. But in the short term, and these complexities are really important, in the short term, Montana in some parts of the state is actually experiencing increased moisture, which can be really a big advantage if you're trying to grow wheat in the early summer. But in late summer, if you get anomalous precipitation, as we have been getting in the last couple of years of storms in late August, early September, it makes grain harvest really tough, or harvesting potatoes and sugar beets tough, which are also important crops in Montana. But for livestock producers, those late summer, early fall rains are great for getting regrowth on pasture before the frost hits. And I could go on and on about how all these different layers affect different components of agriculture. And even within one season, within one farm, you can get both good and bad effects from climate change. Mm. So that's why resilience is really kind of the key, I think, both to adapting on a farm-by-farm level, but also redesigning our food system.
Becky, you are also, as I mentioned a little earlier, you were co-author of the Montana Climate Assessment. How much did ranching, farming, agriculture factor into how the state's looking at climate change?
Well, for each state is doing their own version of a climate assessment. Mm-hmm. And in Montana's case, this initial phase was focused on agriculture, forestry, and water supplies. And so agriculture is extremely important. And it's important to emphasize that the climate discussion was relevant to agriculture, not only because the challenges and benefits that farmers are facing from it, but also because we have to recognize that Montana may be just as significantly affected by global climate shifts, say drought in India and Australia, as it is by direct change on their own farms.
Well, Becky, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Forgive me, but I just got, we have to take a really quick break. So Becky Weed, Daniel Cusick, and Mark Heller, hang on for a moment. We are talking about how climate change is changing agriculture practices. We'll be right back with a lot more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how climate change is changing agricultural practices, or really our food system more broadly. And this conversation was inspired by a terrific series from E&E News. Daniel Cusick is a reporter covering climate adaptation for E&E, and he joins us today from St. Paul, Minnesota. Mark Heller is also a reporter for E&E News as well. He's with us from Washington. And we're also joined today by Becky Weed. She is with us from Belgrade, Montana. She and her husband are sheep ranchers on a 160-acre farm. She's vice chair of the Montana Organic Association and co-author of the Montana Climate Assessment as well. And let's go to Oliver, who's calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Oliver, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Doing well, Oliver. What's your question for today?
So I hate to go back, but I wanted to ask a question about the intermediate wheatgrass. I did a fair amount of research in undergrad at James Madison University about agricultural practices that can turn a farm into more of a carbon sink than a carbon source. And I found that practices like no-till or high biomass winter residue crops were able to effectively increase the carbon concentration in the soil. However, referring back to that wheatgrass, one of the main characteristics of the soil that helped with was the amount of clay and clay aggregates that were formed in the soil because mm-hmm. of cation exchange between the carbon and the soil, the clay in the soil. So I'm wondering if this intermediate wheatgrass, does it have to have the same quality soil to perform as effectively as you guys have stated?
Okay, Oliver, thank you for your call. Daniel Cusick, I guess that one's for you. What do you think?
Well, that's a great question, and it goes to the science of carbon absorption, which is, to say the least, a difficult area to try to draw firm answers about. Nevertheless, I'll give it a shot. So carbon absorption in soil depends on a variety of things. It depends on soil type. It depends on the growing climate or growing season, and also soil management practices. Generally, soil carbon increases with higher clay content because these clay particles essentially bind to the organic carbon. with respect to Kernza, there is still a lot of research on where is the or what is the ideal climate regime for growing Kernza. I can say that to date, much of the work has been done in Kansas and in Minnesota, where test plots have been planted for a number of years to try to refine the crop, not only in terms of its hardiness, but also in terms of its ability to produce grain. But it's still a difficult thing to nail down. Carbon absorption in soil. There are so many variables that go into it. But generally, the science tells us that deep-rooted perennial plants like Kernza or intermediate wheatgrass do a very good job at absorbing and storing carbon.
So Becky Weed, let me turn to you here for a second, because I want to take a step back. I wonder if, you know, we really ought to be thinking, when we're not just talking about targeted agricultural practices, but about the system in general, right? Because so much of our arable land in this country is dedicated to a tiny number of commodity crops, and corn and soy, obviously, in particular. And I'm thinking about the first caller we had near the beginning of the show, Aaron, who called in and said that, you know, he's a rancher and changing his local ranching practices. But he made the point about that so many farmers they've made heavy investments in farming these commodity crops. I mean, is that something that we have to really rethink?
Yes, thank you for the question. I think that is the elephant in the living room. And farmers have made those investments because they have been incentivized to make those investments from the behemoth we call the Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't born corn and soybean farmers, and it has only been the last half century or so that feedlots and corn and soy have been such a domineering part of not only national but global agriculture. And so I think until we address that elephant in the living room, all these other really wonderful constructive discussions of people exploring lots of interesting niches are going to be just that. They're going to remain niches. And so while I really applaud the Land Institute work on a perennial wheatgrass, I think it's really important, and it's been going on for decades, we cannot forget that wheatgrass is a grass. We already know how to grow grass. And I think when people really recognize that millions upon millions of acres in the heartland, richest soil of North America, it's dedicated to crops that aren't really human food. We're primarily growing corn and soy to produce feed for livestock who live in confinement settings, and ethanol and fructose that generates a lot of other unhealthy food and public health problems. So if we look at it on that continental scale, we need to remember that there's this opportunity to restore grassland ecosystems, which can include Kernza, but can also include ways to grow very healthy, ethically produced protein. And that, in turn, produces manure, which instead of being hazardous waste in confined animal feedlot operations, can be the very source of soil vitality and crop fertility that we need. And at the same time, coupled with that discussion, if we didn't sort of distort the economic playing field to drive people to producing corn and soy, then we could re-diversify both our landscape and our crop and food system.
Right.
And I think that Farm Bill backdrop is such a fundamental driver of all the issues we're talking about, that until we can develop and elect political leaders who have a clue how the earth works, we are not going to be able to successfully thrive in the face of climate change.
Well, Becky Weed, joining us from Belgrade, Montana. She and her husband ranch sheep on a 160-acre farm. She's also vice chair of the Montana Organic Association and co-author of the Montana Climate Assessment. Becky Weed, it's been so terrific to talk with you and to hear you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, so Daniel and Mark, stand by here because I want to let some more callers in. Diana is calling from Miami, Florida. Diana, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is, first of all, to compliment you and the host and the guests for this program, because my family owns a ranch in Brazil for over 100 years. And all these things that you guys are talking about, it's nothing new to me, but I appreciate the information and see how things work here, because I live in this country for almost 30 years. And farming and ranching, you know, is very close to my heart. I grew up seeing that. So what I would like to say is it's important for the population, for the listeners, or people in general, to appreciate when they go to the supermarket and they get produce or they get meat of any sort, to understand that it's not there, you know, easily. It has a cost. It's a lot of work, a lot of dedication. And I think that is very important. And normally when people say, oh, my God, this is so expensive, I normally say to them, do you know how much it costs to produce an acre of tomatoes or potatoes or whatever? You know, how much does it cost it to grow an animal to give you the meat?
Yeah.
And I would just do everything very organic on my part of the ranch. And homeopathy for animals. So, I mean, I was just a breed cattle for many years.
Well, you know, Diana, I'm going to take it back from you there for a second, because I hear you saying that it's very critical for us as consumers to think about the true cost of the work that it takes to produce this food. So thank you so much for your call. And on that note, let's go quickly to Jeremy, who's calling from Racine, Wisconsin. Jeremy, what do you think, what role do you think consumers have to play in this changing agriculture issue that we're talking about?
All right. Thanks for taking my call. I think consumers need to address what we are consuming on a daily basis. As a consumer, we drive the demand and what the farmers grow. So if we are heavily consuming beef, pork, and products like that, it's going to create an environment where you're going to have massive monocropping farmland going on throughout the United States. Here in Wisconsin, it's a big issue. So we need to start focusing on retraining people on the benefits of a plant-based diet, and that will have a compounding repercussions throughout the whole food supply in regards to what we grow and what we consume on a daily basis, which will help address the climate issues, as well as utilizing space in an urban environment for direct, locally grown consumer consumption. Curtis Stone has a book called Urban Farmer, and he utilizes people's front lawns. He rents front lawns, and he produces produce for his city, and he grows it yearly, and he makes a profit. He does very well. So there are other ways of doing this.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for your call. Okay, so a lot to chew on there, Daniel and Mark. And Mark, let me just go to you here for a second, because we'll talk about the consumer's role in just a minute. But Jeremy also mentioned sort of just completely other ways of growing food, bringing it closer to the consumer. And that reminded me of a part of your series where I think it was you, Mark, who reported about these vast, like, you know, 30, 40 football field size indoor farming companies, I should say, or places where they're bringing farming closer to urban centers by putting it indoors. Tell me more about that.
That's right. Yeah, these are some of these very big greenhouses. I did visit one down in Georgia that was more of a rural area, but there's also a lot of discussion about indoor facilities in urban areas and in cities. One of the challenges with that being that that real estate is pretty expensive in cities, and that's a bit of a disincentive. But it obviously takes seasonality out of it. And you can grow things, you know, through the year, more or less.
Well, we have some tape here from the Ontario-based company Pure Flavor. They recently spent almost, $105 million on an indoor farm the size of 19 football fields in Fort Valley, Georgia. And you'll hear the company's chief marketing officer, Chris Vayone, describing this state-of-the-art facility.
The unique aspect about greenhouse growing is that we can control 100% of the growing environment. What does that mean? We control the water, the nutrition, the heat, the daylight, the venting, basically providing in a controlled environment the most optimal growing scenario for these plants, which, as you can see over my shoulder here, a consistent size and quality of product.
So that's Chris Van, Chief Marketing Officer for Pure Flavor, an Ontario-based company. I mean, Mark, are we likely to see more of this kind of farming?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think we are likely to see more of it. There are some caveats in that some of these indoor operations, especially if they are not actually greenhouses and need artificial light, they consume energy.
Yeah.
So there are inputs into these things as well. But yeah, I do think we'll see more of this.
Well, so Daniel, let me turn back to you in the last couple of minutes that we have. And there are things that Becky said earlier that I just wanted to get your thoughts on, since you two have been spending so much time reporting on this issue about food and agriculture and climate change. Because, you know, she really implored all of us to take a look at the big picture here, that we have as a nation incentivized certain farming practices which have, you know, led to monoculturing, which have led to investments in agricultural practices that aren't conducive to soil health. I mean, she was talking about the farm bill explicitly. So Daniel, I mean, is that a place that's ripe for change?
It's a great question. Farm policy is a really important part of this because for the most part, over the years, farmers have not been incentivized to provide what are called ecosystem services so much as growing food first and foremost. And from the farmer's perspective, they're quite risk averse, and so the idea of switching from something that they've been doing for their entire lives, and maybe their parents or grandparents were also doing, it's a high risk proposition, not just economically, but also culturally, and so. We are sort of gradually moving to a higher level of awareness nationally. It's a slow process, but it is happening.
Mm. Well, I mean, we've been talking about, I guess, broadly speaking, regenerative farming, right? I mean, is that something that is catching on?
Well, it is. And regenerative farming refers to, I guess you might consider it a philosophy and a set of best practices around farming in a way that is highly sensitive, not only to climate concerns, but also to water quality, other pollution issues around farming. But really at its heart is the combination of carbon storage and soil health, or the interrelationship mm-hmm. between carbon storage and soil health. And this is a small movement, but it's a growing movement. And to speak to sort of consumer issues, you know, we've seen this happen before with organics. The organic food market started as a very small niche market where consumers had to go to small independently owned stores to find organic food. Organics has become a major part of our food system now, in large part because consumers have demanded it.
Yeah.
So the idea is that at some point consumers may or will demand even more from food producers in the way of addressing climate change. And regenerative ag is one of the foremost ways that farmers are trying to do that.
Well, in fact, your series touches on the idea of climate-friendly diets, amongst other things, right? Including meat alternatives, whether insects should play a greater role in what we eat. It's a really terrific series on climate change and agriculture and the food system. So Daniel Cusick and Mark Heller, both from E&E News, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Pleasure. You're welcome.
And by the way, we have a link to the E&E series at our website, onpointradio.org. Definitely check it out. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.